You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Hello. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Today's podcast is titled The Acceleration of Food E-commerce. What does it mean for brands? Now, COVID-19 has obviously provided a boom in online grocery sales as customers avoid going to the shops. And it looks like the impact of all this may well continue to accelerate in food e-commerce. But how can retailers and brands win market share in the online space without the front-of-mind strategies traditionally in play in the physical setting of the supermarket aisles? And this is what I really want to know, is this a secret opportunity to bypass supermarkets entirely with their high margins and their tough game playing with brands? Now, grocery has historically been one of the hardest sectors to shift to e-commerce. Up until March this year, online grocery sales accounted for 7.4% of all UK grocery sales. But as of November 2020, online sales accounted for 11.5. Now, that's a big shift, and presumably it comes with opportunities as well as threats. Now, joining us to discuss this are Dean McElwee, Integrated Commercial Lead for e-commerce at the Kellogg Company. Hello, Dean.
Hello.
And Francis Nicholas, the Group Digital Director at Nomad Foods.
Hello.
Now, Francis, before we start, could you tell us about the grocery e-commerce landscape in the world before COVID-19? Because I don't know if it's just my view of it, but it seemed to stall a little bit in terms of growth and excitement over recent years. Why was it? Is this true? And why was it?
So a couple of years ago, I was asked to do a history lesson to a well-known retailer, and I did a whole slide deck of the earliest I could find people delivering groceries, which was actually 1907. From the Sainsbury's archives, where Sainsbury's used to do bike deliveries to very loyal customers. So we're not going to go that far back. But if we look at what's happened, you're absolutely right. Everything's gone in peaks and troughs. If you think about Webvan in the late 90s and the first sort of dot-com boom, then it went quiet again. But then sort of around 2010, there was another battle for growth where, you know, the retailers were really trying to drive market share and growth. Then I'd say from about 2015 until relatively recently, you know, things were a lot more muted as people focused a lot more on building structural profitability and, you know, just figuring out how to win in this new omnichannel world. So you're absolutely right. It was a lot more muted. Characterized by growth levels starting off in the teens, then going down into the high to mid single digits, but then clearly then the pandemic hit after that. I think ultimately the consumer's the boss, and you know, they'll vote with their feet. And I think from what I can tell across Europe, not just the UK, is a lot of the growth has been driven by the retailer capacity. So as the retailer capacity has been unlocked, most of it in most places tends to get used up. And that's been sort of the rate limiting factor in terms of the growth that we'll see. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens post the pandemic.
Yeah, those early 1900s mobile phone apps must have been pretty glitchy as well back in the day. Now, Dean, when we talk about online sales, for brands, what are the challenges that you've traditionally faced? I mean, what is different for you in that environment to physical sales in supermarkets?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think for us, we face a number of challenges. And I think just using one of our brands, Pringles, Pringles is a great crisp brand that sells very well in virtually every single market we sell in. But when we sell in a physical store, typically we build a large display of Pringles, and you'll walk into the store, you'll still see Pringles, and you'll shop off that. When we now talk about the digital world, we don't have that ability online to build those big, large displays to attract shoppers. So there's just one example of online, you need to do very different things to attract shoppers than you do offline. And for us, that means redesigning the way we work with our retail partners to be able to get the same level of sales that we enjoyed in the physical stores.
And when you say working with them, does that mean throwing money at the problem? in the same sense that that you need to sponsor yourself within a physical retailer, does the same thing happen online?
I think it does to a certain extent, but I think it is about using the retailer's capabilities. So what you have seen during this pandemic is a focus on the retailer's capabilities, particularly in terms of retail media. And by retail media, we mean the banners that you see on the websites and the content that they're showing on the front of the site. So it's working with their platforms to be able to communicate to our shoppers. The great thing about e-commerce is that you can test and learn, and there's lots of data to support making the right decision. So hopefully we're being more efficient on how we spend our money with the retailers than we did before.
Yeah. And does the same thing go for you, Francis? I mean, have you had to adapt your digital strategy to engage in a different way with online customers?
Yeah, I mean, we're coming from a slightly different place in that frozen has always been a category that's really overtraded online. So, you know, to some extent, we're starting from a much higher base than lots of others. But that said, you know, we have seen extreme growth in all sorts of places. So what that's allowed us to do is, on the one hand, accelerate some of the commercial innovations or test and learns that we've been wanting to work on. Because ironically, once we've been through lockdowns, there's been a lot more appetite to try new things. But at the same time, you know, I'm always the one banging on about just executional excellence, because all that consumers and shoppers see is execution, whether it's good or not so good. So it's also allowed me to, you know, really drive people across our company, but also with the retailers, just to focus on the basics, you know, even as much as, are your pack shots up to date, and you know, where are you on stock, and if you've got stock issues, what can you do to merchandise slightly differently so you can drive where you do have stock. So
can you make any examples of these things?
Yeah, I mean, if we think about, you know, the stock, we've had to do some, you know, quick step changes in some of our ranges and our promotion plans, where we've just, you know, seen some of our most popular products going out of stock, and, you know, what can we replace them with, you know, whilst it's taking time to get replenished. So that's a good example of where we've had to, in real time, work collaboratively with our partners to make the best of what we've got available. And then we've also been working more recently on working with our partners to retain the new shoppers. It's quite interesting when you talk to the retailers, you know, some of the growth that they're seeing, much bigger numbers than I would have expected, are actually brand new shoppers to the entire retailer. Yeah. So we've got some programs in place with a few to try and, you know, help them retain those new shoppers. So not just within our category, but in general. And, you know, we've got some real live examples right now, which is quite exciting.
And do you find that, I mean, you're referring to the retailers as partners. Does that partnership relationship change when you're working online, or is it pretty much the same in the way that it feels in the physical space of the supermarket?
So for me, in the most mature markets, and let's face it, we're talking the UK today predominantly, the days of having a separate online team in the corner who don't even know who the core team, those days are completely gone. And in fact, if anything, it's gone the other way. Mm. You know, e-commerce is so instrumental for any category director or trading director these days. They have to be paying as much attention to it now as they are with their main store estate or their convenience estate. So I find that quite liberating, actually, because now, you know, we can be having an honest multi-channel conversation with our retailer partners to say, okay, this is what we're going to do. But what does that how does that manifest itself in convenience and online as much as it does in main store estate, where maybe previously the crux of the conversation would have been about the main estate store plan.
And Dean, do you find the same thing happening for the Kellogg Company, that coming together of teams, or even possibly sort of the merging of teams?
Yes, absolutely. I think what Francis said is absolutely true. You know, if you look at some of our categories, our cereals category, for example, in Q3 of last year, we sold almost 28% of our total turnover online through some of our major customers in the UK. So getting success with those retailers is about working on both the online and the offline together, because the reality for those shoppers are that they're both online and potentially offline shoppers. And it's about making sure that you have the total proposition that that shopper is going to see, whether it's online or offline, harmonized, joined up, and that they're having the same experience, whether they're in-store or online.
So what's most important then? Or I guess most important is a quantitative sort of question to a qualitative issue, really. But you know, is it about stock? Is it about marketing? Is it about retail relationships? I mean, presumably marketing changes, and the way that you market food online. I know you're saying that teams merge, but it must work very differently, both in terms of the costs and the practical aspects of doing these things. What's the thing that keeps you both up at night? In terms of the things you need to get right.
Francis alluded to it, and it's brilliant basics and execution. Succeeding in e-commerce for us, certainly at Kellogg's, is about making sure that we've got the right content, the right images of our product, and most importantly, that when you go and search for a product to add to your basket, that you actually come up with our products. And being able to make sure that our shoppers can find our products is really, really what we need to, what we focus on. And really the key for that is be brilliant basics, get the execution really, really good, because the reality is this is the experience that the shop is going to have. And in some cases for the shoppers, it's the only way they get to experience your brand. They don't get to pick up the pack in store, turn it over, have a look at the back of the pack. Often the websites are nowadays the only place that they get to interact with your brand.
So, Francis, is it the same for you that you need to try and achieve that sort of tactile sensory experience through images and not through somebody seeing the product there? Is that a big challenge?
Sort of. So what do I mean by that answer? You know, the reality is, in the grocery online shopping environment, the majority of purchases are replenishment purchases. So, you know, the majority are, you know, products that people have bought before or they're aware of. You know, we did some studies a couple of years ago with the now defunct My Supermarket, and we looked into the analytics on this in quite a lot of detail, and we saw that less than 10% of people were looking at the back of pack information to learn more. So that's why my hypothesis is, you know, having rich content and then that sort of virtual tactile feel is probably more important than for NPD and new products, or for people joining the category for the first time rather than the replenishment purchases, which are the majority. I mean, and the other thing I would say is, you know, I worked at Procter & Gamble for many years, and I worked on most of the portfolio, including Pringles, as was. And purchasing like a really expensive powered toothbrush, you do want to have all of that rich content. You do want to have that experience, because the key though is it's a purchase frequency of probably once every few years. Yeah. Whereas a lot of the products that Nomad, but also Kellogg's represent, are those weekly purchases that are lower ticket prices. So yeah, I think the role of the tactile look and feel is very different in grocery to what it would be in lots of non-food, you know, high value types of categories. So I don't think there's the pressure in the same way.
And as well as, I mean, you've both been talking about the fact that you've got to be found, you know, in the digital space. You go to a supermarket website, you've got to be visible there. But how about what about the sort of secondary marketing channels, like, you know, getting influencers to sponsor things, you know, having brand ambassadors and the things that are less quantifiable in terms of we did this work and somebody clicked on it? Is that still important to you, and has the balance of effort and money that you put into that sort of marketing changed?
Yes, I think from our point of view, we have playbooks and activation guidelines in all sorts of areas, but I think if we step back and look at sort of the Byron Sharp approach in this world of physical availability and mental availability, I think basically it's all about, you know, if you want to shout about your new piece of innovation, you know, make sure all of the relevant touch points, whether they're powered by marketing or powered by sales, are all using the same key visuals and using the same message. So one thing we try and do is absolutely try and make sure that we're absolutely aligned across all the way from the top of the funnel all the way through to the bottom of the funnel, which is up to and including the retailer. So, you know, if with that particular innovation or category, we've got influence we're trying to lever, then great. But yeah, I think that that's my biggest learning on this one is try and have a consistent story, message, the message being visual as much as words, on all the touch points you're choosing to activate against for that particular category or initiative, where increasingly the retailer is an important touch point, clearly.
Yeah. And Dean, what do you think about this? Do you think that the marketing balance has changed because of e-commerce?
I think the
way that you put your message across.
Yeah, I think the emphasis has changed. So what I mean by that is certainly we're shifting more spend to digital. But I think, you know, Francis called out touch points, and that's a great shout, because what we are experiencing is that people shop, and they shop across many different platforms, and they research across many different platforms. So what you'll often find people doing is they are researching on the Asda website, for example, and they may not make a transaction at that point, but they're doing research there. Mm. So it's about communicating to them at that particular touch point and Asda's community of shoppers, or it may be Amazon's community of shoppers. So Amazon itself is a media channel. So what we are seeing is that some of the retailers are becoming media channels, and in fact, some of the media channels themselves are trying to become retailers. So we are seeing a bit of that movement. It's just important that if you put the shopper in the center of this, that you are communicating to them in that consistent, joined-up approach, whether it is on TV, online, on an Amazon site, on an Asda site, or on an Instagram page.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned that consumers are researching more than ever. So I've got a tangential question for you. Does the word blockchain make you both sort of raise your eyes to the ceiling and think, oh, yeah, really? Are people going to go that far? Or is this going to be a vital part of the future of how products are marketed?
I think the jury's out. I mean, the thing is, blockchain is not a new conversation. I mean, it's been knocking around for years, if I'm honest. So yes, there's a lot more focus on digital powered and end-to-end digitally enabled past purchase. And, you know, there is an appeal to blockchain. There are no doubts about it. So is it time now? Yeah, maybe. I really, you know, I haven't got much more to say about that one. I've got to be candid.
Yeah. Do you have anything else to add to that?
I think blockchain is a very interesting technology, but certainly in the food industry and the FMCG retailing space, it's about deciding where and how to use it. So given the use of blockchain, it's getting quite a lot of traction in things like traceability of products through supply chains and post-retail purchase. So I think that it's about the right application for blockchain in the right places.
And potentially not necessarily for consumers. It has lots of different applications that aren't consumer-focused.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is the area that I'm really interested in. Now, there's been an enormous growth in during lockdown of brands that have been moving to direct consumer sales. Now, I wonder, I mean, Francis, why is this? I mean, is it just the obvious thing of cutting out somebody who's taking a margin, or is there something a little bit more important than that?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons for it. And I think the first one is because you can. There's a new toy or a new outlet that you can play with. Let's go and play and see what happens. You know, that would be the first spontaneous answer. But, you know, being a bit more serious, you know, our retail partners are always under a lot of pressure when it comes to SKU proliferation. And ironically, actually, sometimes we find that having a tighter range actually delivers more for everybody involved. But that's a different conversation. But, you know, if I was in the shoes of being a challenger brand, which in some ways our portfolio isn't, you know, if you're struggling to get widespread distribution, you can see the attraction of sort of shipping direct to consumers, you know, via the UK parcel networks, as an example, which gives you sort of 90% plus geographical coverage. If you then layer on top of that sort of ownership of the full path of purchase, you know, I can see why there's a lot of attractiveness there and why people might be wanting to start trialing that approach. But what's also interesting is, you know, all the private equity money out there, you know, I was trying to find some stats for this in terms of the amount of crowdfunding last year. But from what I can tell, a lot of people who were launching food and drink were just going directly to consumer. So it's almost like, you know, it's almost like the initial channel now that a lot of startups are using, just like, I'm going to go directly to the consumer and see how I can go. Although, ironically, if you look at the Grays model, you know, that's what they did. And then they went into retail after a few years to really get the growth. So, yeah, I think there's a whole bunch of elements there. But clearly, it's accelerated. There are no doubts about that.
And is Nomad Foods interested in this area? Do you have a proportion of direct-to-consumer sales?
I mean, obviously, we look at everything. Nothing's ever off the table. But at the end of the day, we've got so many opportunities still with our existing partners. I think let's unlock all of those first.
Dean, what do you think about this? I mean, I'm neither a brand nor a retailer. So I look at the relationship and I think, surely you must kind of secretly want to be free of that burden, don't you?
It can often be called a burden. I think it's about balancing the needs and being very clear on what D2C delivers for you. D2C delivers value in a number of different ways. So some companies get into it from the insights that you get from people shopping directly with you and that closer relationship that you have with the consumer, which in a world of GDPR and privacy is potentially more valuable for a lot of brands. We're using it in a very interesting space at the moment on product and concept incubation, where we have a product that is not really ready for retail just yet. And we want to test and be able to test and learn very quickly. And that's a great feature of e-commerce and D2C, is being able to test, learn, get a lot of feedback very quickly before we scale a launch into the wider retail market. Yeah. So we're using it from that point of view, from product and concept incubation point of view. So I think there are a number of different value drivers that you can see that brands use this. How do I engage and build my brand through this? Coca-Cola just launched a site in the UK about 3-4 weeks ago called Your Coca-Cola, and that allows you to go and purchase their products on there. Now, you would often sit there and say, well, I can get those products in my local supermarket, Dean. Why would I go onto that site? But what they've added into there is various merchandise, so they're branded merchandise, which gives the shopper a different view of the product and enables them to connect with the brand in a different way. So there are reasons for doing it, which can be very useful for brands to embed themselves in consumers' lifestyles.
Now, Francis hinted at the idea that, you know, if you go direct to consumers, you hold the data, and this is very important and very useful for how you market, how you stock. Do you feel that your retail partners give you enough data for you to make insightful decisions about the business? Do you get enough from the retailers?
Do we get enough data? We always want more data. so the answer is, we would love a lot more than we're currently getting.
And so, do you ask for it and it doesn't come? Is that how the relationship works?
I think it's a combination of two or three things. Firstly, it's an issue of the cost and the availability of the data and the ability of the retailer to provide the data. Mm. In certain cases, it may be the maturity of the analytical capabilities of retailers. Certainly, when you do marketing on retailers' websites, you want to be, the ideal state is to be able to measure the impact of that both online and offline to see what the effect is. And not all of the retailers are as evolved in that space at the moment, but that's coming and accelerating very quickly.
Yeah.
So, and then I think thirdly, it's an internal capabilities issue for a lot of businesses. How to mine and get real value out of this data to make better decisions.
And Francis, does the same go for you, that you just always want more data? And do you have, are you grumpy about the levels of data and the passing of that data from your retail partners?
Yep. So the stock answer will always be, we want more data. But actually, our experience is quite positive. But what I've realized over the years is if you've got a clear strategy with, clear benefits to the consumer, the retailer, and us at the end almost, then we've got some quite positive experience actually, where the retailers have mined the data. We haven't seen all the data, but you can tell they've done the work and they've done it well, and which has then morphed into proof of concepts, which has then morphed into ongoing activation. So I think the challenge, careful what you wish for, because let's supposing retailer X gave me all of his data. I haven't got the capacity or the skills in my company to mine it properly. Mm. What I'd rather do is work with what's there and really understand what's the unmet consumer need in particular that we can solve. And I think if we work together, then we've got a track record of a few examples now where we've been able to do stuff with some of the partners, and deliver some really exciting results. And also my experience is quite often, if you've got that clear problem you're trying to solve together, actually the limiter is often that the retailer doesn't actually create that data or harvest or record that data. Mm-hmm. So it's not a case if they don't want to share it with you, it's they didn't actually have the capability to to create it.
Yeah.
But I think that this is it's a whole different subject, is data science and strategy and data lakes and everything. But what I would say is I can clearly see in the trade, data and insights and analytics teams growing and what's refreshing is seeing a lot of database decision making going on behind the scenes. You don't always see it when you log into somebody's online site, but actually there's a lot more going on behind the scenes than you think with most of the retail trade now, and it's an exciting and a good way actually.
I've never heard the phrase data lake before. I love that. And I can just imagine the conspiracy theories lurking in that data lake as well. Now, there are more and more marketplaces popping up now. Amazon is the obvious one, but there are various different ones as well, small and large. Francis, do you think this is a good thing? Is it just another layer of difficulty and another route? And would selling through one marketplace cannibalize your sales through another? How do you feel about the proliferation of these marketplaces?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I said before was the consumer is the boss, and we should never, ever forget about that as a manufacturer. So you're right. The world is much more complex with many more marketing or sales channels to deal with. You go back 20 years, life was a lot more complex. People like me and Dean didn't exist in our current manifestations because, e-commerce and the way it exists today didn't really exist. Mm. So you're absolutely right. There's a lot more complexity to deal with now. But at the same time, there's a lot of opportunity. So as an example, the tech is almost there. There's a bit of work to do from the GDPR or whatever we're calling it now after we've exited the EU, to have legitimate and robust ways of engaging with consumers. But, you can see now that being able to deliver personalization at scale is possible, and that offers so much opportunity. Just think, if Stefan, I know your background, I can target you with propositions and services, not even just products, based on what I think will really resonate with you. Mm. Where currently everything is a mess, right? We're going to do this save a third promotion for everybody. Actually, the world is now morphing into a place where we can get a lot more personalized and targeted. And I think it's really exciting because you can start really having personalized conversations and relationships. And obviously the retailers lead that today, although lots of manufacturers are creating their own databases. But I think over time that can, you know, create huge amounts of value for the whole industry, if I'm honest. But ultimately also the consumer and the shopper.
And Dean, I mean, we're talking about personalization, and we've been talking a lot in these podcasts about personalized diets, possibly based on gut microbiome and things like that. Do you think that it would ever go that far for you, that you would be able to or contemplate products that could be personalized in terms of their nutritional content to a particular consumer? Or is that just too far away to be on the horizon?
I don't think it's as far away as you think it might be. I think the D2C site that we've launched at the end of last year is our first iteration of this, where we're providing a quiz to shoppers to understand their nutritional needs and then providing a suggested product range based on that potential need. Mm. So I don't think it's as far away as you think it might be. One of the other companies that I've spoken to pretty recently in this space is a fantastic crowd called Karakuri, who are based out of London, and they are doing robot nutrition. So effectively, the robot puts together your meal, and there's an investment from Mercado in the company. And they are creating meals for you based on robotic inputs. So you go and tell them that you'd want, for example, a granola with this particular yogurt, some extra sunflower seeds on it, and the robot prepares it for you. And and they launched their first one in the Ocado canteen at the Ocado offices late last year. So I think it's starting to come in, and that personalized nutrition space is definitely a future development area for us all.
I guess you can never say no to any of these potential issues, can you? Now, Francis, do you think that the different marketplaces can support brands with new product development? Are there test areas for selling these things, and if so, do you need to do it undercover? You know, would the larger retailers be annoyed that their partnership with you is being compromised in some way?
Yeah, I mean, you could also do that with your larger retailers. I think there's always been lots of different ways of delivering, what should I say, market research or test market pilots. You know, marketplaces are, inverted commas, just another outlet to do that. And you're right, if it's just about the product taste, then you can maybe even go unbranded if you're not bothered about understanding about the propositions. I think, yeah, marketplaces are just another opportunity on the list to try and learn.
Okay. And Francis, and now let's just think about a little bit about online customers. What is the secret ingredient to winning and retaining brand loyalty online? So obviously you've got some big legacy brands there, but how do you stand out in a market that's continually changing?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of elements here. I mean, the first thing is I worked at P&G for many years. We had the famous first and second moments of truth. You know, ultimately, if you start with the second moment of truth, have you got a great tasting product that people will come back to? That's ultimately got to be what you're driving. And then in terms of the first moment of truth, the touch and feel, we actually talked about that earlier in this cast in terms of, what's the virtual look and feel and tactile feel look like? So I think for me, it's all about understanding, continuing to learn, continuing to optimize in the channels you're using to drive your mental availability and your physical availability. But at the same time, continuing to test and learn. There's all sorts of things that have emerged even pre-pandemic that we were starting to get into or on our list. And there's always going to be a list, isn't there? And if it's the latest social selling technique or direct selling on a 30-minute delivery site, there's always going to be a list. You've got to just keep having the pipeline full and continue learning some of the new things and then figure out in your overall sort of mix, you know, what role they have to play or not.
So what you're saying is there's no secret ingredient. You actually have to do hard work. Damn.
Yes, unfortunately. Damn. So.
Okay. Dean, what do you think about that?
I couldn't agree more. I think there's no easy solution, is there? And there never will be. This is about testing and learning and testing and trialing and understanding that it's not a one-size-fits-all. So what works for our cereal business, for example, may not work for our Pringles business. Mm. And so we need to test and learn on both and seize the opportunities as they exist. You know, one of the great things, and it's COVID is a real challenge, and we understand the challenges that a lot of people are having in the COVID environment. But from an e-commerce point of view, you've got so much traffic on sites that this is your one of your best opportunities to test and learn things, trial new things, get insights, because there's very few occasions that websites are as busy as they are now.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And now, this is a sort of slightly tangential question, but you know, I have a deep love of science, and one of the guiding principles is that when something doesn't work, you learn from that as much as you learn from something that does work, and that failure is a useful tool as well. Can you both give me an example of something that you tried to do as part of your e-commerce that didn't work? Francis, if you could start.
I'm just trying to think what I can tell you. Because I do have
a
long
list.
Yeah, no, it's a tricky area. Because obviously no one ever gets anything wrong, right? That's right, a standard stock answer. I think I'm on the mission. You like this. So one of the reasons I joined Nomad Foods is, at least when I joined, is that, you know, frozen was an underappreciated category with lots of positives to it. So, you know, we can get portions of fruit and veg to your plate with a lot less waste than other channels. But I think the one that I'm quite passionate about at the moment is trying to help everybody nudge them in terms of eating their five a day. So I can't remember what the numbers are in front of me, but it's something like, and every government across Europe has a different measure just to make things fun, but it's something like, if it's the guidance in the UK is you should be eating five a day, I think the average UK consumer is on about 3.2, 3.4, that type of amount. So we're doing all sorts of stuff behind the scenes to try and, in a positive way, just try and get another portion of peas or mixed vegetables into people's baskets. And out of that, we've got some things that working, but a lot of things that haven't been working. So yeah, it's definitely a journey. So that would be my.
If someone can crack that, then I take my hat off and will eat my shoes and all sorts, because I think that's a mountain to climb, isn't it? Dean, any things that didn't work for you? Or, well, things that didn't work. You know, lots of things did work for you.
Yeah, it's a hard one. You never remember the ones that didn't work. You always remember the ones that work really well, don't you? So certainly I can't off the top of my head give you any examples, but it's definitely a behavior that we're trying to embed in the teams in this year, is to try something and learn from the failure, because the failure will help us improve. So how can we try new things and fail so that we can improve our proposition?
Okay. You've both avoided the question beautifully there, and I thank you for it. Now, we need to wrap this up. We could talk about this for hours on end. It's absolutely fascinating. But just very, very briefly, do you have any predictions for growth in online shopping? And this could be a hunch rather than any you know, data that you're going to, you know, stake your job on. What do you reckon is going to happen with online sales over the next, just over the next year, let's say? Francis, if you can start.
So I think a lot of our retailer partners have gained a lot of new shoppers, so they'll be wanting to hang on to them. That would probably be the most important or the lead driver. And then I think behind that then will be operating improvements. So there's a whole debate about the profitability of the channel. So I think you'll see a lot more work there behind the scenes in terms of some people moving more to urban fulfillment centers, dark stores to work on the pick costs. I think there's a lot of opportunity for better monetizing the value of last mile delivery versus what happens today. So I think that there are a couple of big things that will happen. And then once those things are going in a good direction, I think you'll see a lot more innovation happening again.
And the things will ramp up, I guess. And Dean, what are your predictions for the future of e-commerce? Where do you see it moving?
Yeah, certainly very similar to Francis in many ways. So profitability is a challenge, has been a challenge for a lot of retailers, and they've all invested significantly in capacity driven by COVID. So how do they optimize that? How do they make that a more seamless experience for shoppers and improve the experience for shoppers? I think that the second big one we see that they will be focusing on is part of the profitability question is answered by a focus on retail media. So the category banners and all the content that they show on their site. I think a lot of them will focus a lot on that this year as a means to try and plug that hole in the profitability question that they're seeing. The third one that we're seeing, and we're seeing it expanding in the US market, it's in the French market and the German market, not yet in the UK, but rumored to be launching this year, is the rise of the omni-channel marketplaces. So this would be the likes of a Tesco, Asda, Sainsbury's, who would operate in some ways like an Amazon. They will put products in their site, which they will sell off there, but they won't physically be holding the stock. They'll be asking you to deliver that as the seller of the stock. And we see that in a number of our markets. So I was just having a conversation with somebody this morning about Carrefour selling Pringles that are imported from the US on the Carrefour France website next to our Pringles that we supply in that market. And I think retailers will do that to monetize those platforms and offer a broader range to their shoppers and consumers. And I think that's definitely one of the ones as a manufacturer you need to look out for.
I think the phrase cheeky buggers springs to mind there, really, doesn't it?
It may be somewhat cheeky buggers. I think it also presents an opportunity. If you are a brand like ours and you have the ability to, let's say the retailer may not take that particular SKU into their stores, we can still sell it online if we can do the fulfillment ourselves on the platform. So I think it presents both opportunities as well as threats for brands, and it's looking for the opportunity that we're focused on.
Yeah, and I think that's a great comment to end this particular podcast on. Well, Francis and Dean, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been absolutely fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Dean McElwee and Francis Nicholas. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which explore the future of retail, joined by Mark Watkins of Nielsen, Sam Roscoe from the University of Sussex, and Shane Brennan from the Cold Chain Federation. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Dean and Francis, thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.